State of Texas and Little Elm Plaza Limited versus same. If the clerk will please announce counsel who are arguing today.
May it please report, Mr. Brian Charles Fred Kelly, and Mr. Charles 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 Charles
All right, Ms. Bonin.
May it please the court. My name is Susan Bonin, and I represent the state of Texas. The state requests that the trial court's judgment be reversed because the trial court erred in admitting Little Elm's evidence regarding remainder damages and in excluding the state's evidence regarding remainder damages. In addition, because Little Elm's opinions regarding damages were irrelevant, unreliable, and speculative, there was either no evidence or insufficient evidence to support the jury's verdict. And finally, the state requests that the court overrule the issues raised in the cross appeal. However, unless the court has specific questions about the cross issues, I plan to concentrate on the state's issues during oral argument and rely on the briefing regarding the cross issues. First, with respect to Little Elm's remainder damages opinions, these opinions were based on the assumption that Little Elm would be required to cure all nonconformities on its property, including those that were pre-existing, thereby requiring demolition of all of the buildings on the property, leading to $4 million in damages. However, this assumption was patently false, making Little Elm's expert opinions irrelevant, unreliable, and speculative. There's overwhelming evidence of the falsity of this assumption. First, on its face, Ordinance 918 provides an exemption for nonconformities caused by an acquisition, but it did not require that pre-existing nonconformities be eliminated. The town itself construed Ordinance 918 as not requiring Little Elm to cure all pre-existing nonconformities, and the town said so in an agenda information sheet for a town council meeting, and its director of planning and development testified that Ordinance 918 did not require any such thing, and that, in fact, that specific ordinance had superseded a letter that was issued by this very same person some 7 months prior to the state's acquisition of the property. The town of Little Elm has not revoked any certificates of occupancy, and in fact, prior to trial, it adopted a conceptual site plan that did not require Little Elm to cure pre-existing nonconformities. Going on, Little Elm's own appraiser stated in his report that there was nothing on its face in 918 that would require Little Elm to cure pre-existing nonconformities. He testified that such a requirement would be inconsistent with his experience, and he considered that assumption as an extraordinary assumption that if it were false, he would have to change his entire appraisal. And he suggested that it was arguably non-constitutional.
And let me ask, Ordinance 918 was in place at the date of taking?
Yes, Your Honor, it was. It was passed on October 8th, 2008. The date of acquisition was not until April 22nd of 2009, slightly over 6 months later. Another witness, Little Elm's plan planning expert, stated in a memorandum that he sent to the town that he had determined that Little Elm would only need to cure new nonconformities for which they had received some payment to cure, and he prepared a post-acquisition site plan that did not cure pre-existing nonconformities, and that particular plan was approved by the town council.
But those events took place after the date of taking?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact,
So how do we get those in?
Well, those are relevant. Well, first of all, I think we're right and that there was error regardless of whether you look at what happened after the date of taking because of what 918 does on its face. But because the whole concept of highest and best use always requires you to look at what might be reasonably probable in the future. That opens up the opportunity to look at what happened after the tate of take. And here in this case, where in the land of, well, the concept of highest and best use takes into account, not only a property's current use, but how it might be reasonably adapted in the future. And, you know, that applies to appraisals of the remainder after as well as the whole before. So in looking... Well, I'm saying you have to look, you have to value property as of the date of taking. But because the highest and best use has an element of looking forward, there is an opportunity to consider things that happened after the date of take. Finally, we have, of course, the opinions of the state's own witnesses who did not believe that all pre-existing nonconformities had to be cured. And because of these, this assumption was patently false, the opinion of $4 million in remainder damages, which was based on this assumption and relied on this assumption, those opinions were irrelevant because they were not tied to the facts of the case, because they were relying on something that was not true. They were unreliable because they were based on this false and speculative assumption and the unreliable data of this interpretation of the town's policies. And finally, just in and of themselves, the opinions and the theory was remote, speculative, and conjectural. And, you know, the state objected to all of this in its pretrial motions, and the state's objections were overruled. Because of the nature of this evidence, we believe this court should look to its own opinion in the Coble case. In Coble, this court found that damages based on the cost of complying with an ordinance that was unlikely to ever be applied were remote, speculative, and conjectural. Now, likewise here, damages resulting from a non-existing requirement that all pre-existing nonconformities be cured are remote, speculative, and conjectural, and any opinions based on those assumptions should have been excluded. We believe that this is reversible error and probably did cause a rendition of an improper judgment. The jury's verdict on remainder damages was approximately $2.2 million, but the only admissible evidence of remainder damages was the state evidence in the amount of approximately $1.1 million. Therefore, we believe that the error was harmful and is reversible. Second, with respect to the state's evidence that was excluded regarding remainder damages, the state's appraiser had two appraisal scenarios, and his scenario two appraisal utilized what has been called a dogleg portion of the property, which I think if you've looked at any of the pictures of the property, and those are contained in exhibits C and D to the state's original brief, you will understand what the dogleg is. It's the little extra triangle attached to the property. Yes, Your Honor. But it was actually being used as part of the commercial property. So it, in and of itself, had a pre-existing, legally non-conforming use.
Would we get to speculate if it could be used on the commercial?
No, Your Honor, you wouldn't. And because under the Canizo case by the Texas Supreme Court, the court actually said that you can consider evidence of zoning changes that are reasonably probable within the reasonable future. And there was a plethora of evidence of that in this particular case. I mean, first, you have to consider the fact that in determining remainder damages, any property for which there is a unity of use may be considered. And so this dogleg portion was already being used in conjunction with the entire property. So regardless of the zoning, there was a unity of use, and the appraiser should have been allowed to consider that in determining his damages.
Are you looking at the photograph that you referenced?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't see any use. I don't see any cars. I don't see any parking spaces. I don't believe that I see paving.
Mm-hmm.
I don't seem to see in the photograph.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Your Honor, if you look at C, Exhibit C, yes, Your Honor, yes, and the paving is not clearly defined, but there is, in fact, paving there, and if you see where it says curb opening, one can actually drive across there and access South Park Drive, and there was testimony, in fact, from Mr. Sandridge, the property owner's representative, that driveway was used to access the property both by employees and patrons. You're right, it wasn't currently being used for parking spaces, but it was being used as a driveway. The whole center, the driveway is not, the parking lots and drives are not in perfect condition, and this particular drive is in even worse condition, but it is there and you can drive across it. And there was testimony to that effect. But even if it hadn't already been being used, it was reasonably probable that it would be allowed to be used in the future for a number of different reasons. I mean, first, you have the fact that it was already a legally non-conforming use. The state's witnesses testified that it was reasonably probable that the zoning would be changed. And more importantly, the town council approved a site plan that utilized that area as a driveway, that made it specifically clear that it could be used as part of the commercial property. And then all of the appraisers, both the state's appraisers and Little Elm's appraisers, at some point said that the highest and best use of the entire piece of property, including the dog leg portion, was as light commercial. It's only when they decided to try and get the state's evidence excluded that suddenly they started pointing out that, well, that has residential zoning, but they didn't change their appraisals and take away the fact that they had made these determinations that it had a highest and best use as commercial property. And if you look at the definition of highest and best use that was used in the charge, the concept of what will be allowed within a reasonable future is actually in that definition of highest and best use. So when all of these appraisers said that it had a commercial highest and best use, they were establishing that it could be used that way. And in fact, Little Elm makes an argument in its own brief arguing that portion of property has a highest and best use as a commercial property. The bottom line, we believe that the state was entitled, or that the jury was entitled to hear the state's competing evidence of valuation, which the competing evidence was the appraisal that determined damages in the neighborhood of about $250,000 instead of the $1 million appraisal that the state was forced to testify on. These opinions as to this alternative scenario were clearly central to the main issue in this case, which was, in fact, remainder damages. Our third issue, which is...
Before you go on, let me ask something.
Yes, Your Honor.
At one point you said that your appraisal would support a remainder damage amount of $1.1 million, mm-hmm. but now you just said it's $250,000?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the state's appraiser prepared two appraisals, one assuming that the dogleg portion could be used for parking and one assuming that it could not. And the state intended to use the one that assumed it could be used, which determined damages of $250,000. But because the court excluded that evidence, the state was forced to go with the testimony that had the scenario one, which did not use the dogleg portion of the property to cure and instead involved cutting one of the buildings and determined remainder damages of approximately $1.1 million.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Relatedly, we believe that the court, for some of the same reasons we've already given, we believe the court erred in excluding Ordinance 954 and the conceptual site plan that did, in fact, occur after the date of acquisition. And finally, because the landowner's evidence was not competent, That evidence is no evidence or insufficient evidence to support the jury's verdict that was approximately $1.1 million over any evidence that was admitted. And we believe that is an additional reason why this case should be reversed and that the state is entitled to a new trial. We're not asking for rendition because our no evidence point was raised in our motion for new trial and not by any other method. For all of these reasons discussed here today and those contained in the state's brief, the state asks that this court reverse the trial court's judgment, grant a new trial, and that the cross issues be overruled.
I have a procedural question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it your opinion that if the trial court erred in excluding Ordinance 954, the conceptual site plan, and the expert testimony of Mr. Wright and Mr. Hudson, is it necessary to reach the other issues? Would it be necessary for this court to reach the other issues?
Yes, it would be. Because even if all of the state's evidence were stricken, you still have the problem that the landowner's evidence is not reliable. It doesn't matter. I mean, that if you look at the State versus Bristol case decided by the Texas Supreme Court, if you look carefully at the facts, that you had that very scenario where actually the state's opinions were stricken, but the state attacked the landowner's opinions because they were based on non-compensable access, and the Supreme Court ruled for the state. You still have a problem. There's still insufficient evidence to support the judgment, and there's still unreliable opinions. So those two errors still remain, even if you thought that the trial court was correct in striking the state's evidence.
No, my question was if the trial court was incorrect.
Yes, I'm so sorry.
Okay.
Yes, if... I think if you decide that the state's evidence should have been admitted, then the state is entitled to a new trial, and you wouldn't have to reach the other issues.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bonin. Mr. Salazar.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Salazar. I'm here along with trial counsel and co-appellate counsel with Ms. Catherine Kasten and Eddie Vasallo. Each of us participated in the trial court proceeding in which the court is considering today. And my argument today will be limited to what the state has presented in terms of error committed by the trial court. And I would submit to this court that the trial court did not commit error, that such that this case should be reversed and remanded to the trial court itself. Although, on the other hand, we did file a cross appeal with respect to pretrial issues that occurred relating to the discovery process that the state failed to engage in and that the rules violated by the state ultimately unfairly surprised and unduly prejudiced the property owner during the course of this condemnation proceeding. And we asked myriad of times during the course of the proceeding itself for the trial court to reconsider its pretrial ruling, for the trial court to reconsider any issue related to each individual witness before their testimony, during their testimony, and after their testimony, and we ask that the testimony be stricken. So we've preserved the error, and we ask this court, in the event that you will grant cross-appellant's brief and points of error, that you reverse and you render the decision based on the evidence which was presented by the landowner's single appraisal witness. Now, turning to the state's brief itself and the errors which are presented, I apologize to the court, but I'm going to take their issues that they presented out of order. First and foremost, we have issue number 3, which is whether the trial court erred in excluding evidence as it relates to ordinance number 954 and a concept plan which was approved by the town of Little Elm. The chronology is very important for this court in terms of What evidence is available in considering damages to this property? What's available for a jury to consider when they're looking at what the town is enforcing with respect to its ordinances? We have a date of take on April 22nd, 2009. And we have ordinance number 954, which was enacted May 19th, 2009. Clearly after the date of take, and clearly something which this court should never allow to be presented to the jury, because there is no evidence in the record with respect to the town contemplating the enactment of ordinance 954. The only thing that we have in the record during the pretrial proceeding itself is ordinance 954 was passed by the town on May 19, 2009. So ordinance 954 provides a waiver or a variance to ordinance number 918. So we, the landowner, the state, as of April 22, 2009, only have ordinance 918 to make a determination about what the town will or could do with respect to analyzing the Little Elm Plaza property. Next, we have the state relying heavily upon a concept plan which was submitted to the town council. The concept plan was submitted to the town council on September 7, 2010, clearly after the date of take. And I would submit to the court that the agenda item, which is making a presentation of the concept plan to the town council, says the parties, TxDOT and Little Elm Plaza, would like some direction from the town council about what the town council will do with respect to this property and its after configuration. Obviously, the parties were engaged in some sort of communication, and the parties were together in seeking some relief from the town council. I would submit to the court that the planning analysis that was performed by Mr. Baldwin and the concept plan, which was ultimately approved by the town council, are clearly after the date of take and are clearly settlement negotiations and should never have been presented to the jury. And I would submit to the court that there is other reasons why those two pieces of information should never be presented to the jury. In a condemnation case, sales data permitted to be admitted into court to establish value even after the date of take. But that sales data is only admissible in the event the offering party demonstrates the market has not changed. So we have a similar market after the date of take, and we have a sale after the date of take, and the offering party demonstrates there's no change in the market. What we have with respect to Ordinance 954 and the concept plan is a change in the market. The state cannot establish that the market did not change because Ordinance 954 is indeed an alteration of the facts which exist on April 22nd, 2009. Consequently, Ordinance 954 and the concept plan were properly excluded from consideration and presentation to the jury, and the trial court did not make an error in doing so. Turning to the state's appraisals. The state alleges that they had two appraisals, when in fact the record at the pretrial proceeding will demonstrate clearly the state had three alternative real estate appraisals. One appraisal, all we had was just the sheet, one page, signed by the real estate appraiser, who said value for the Little Elm Plaza property as a result of this acquisition is $1.8 million. Then we have the second scenario, one real estate appraisal, which does not utilize the single family tract and has a damage analysis to the Little Elm Plaza property of roughly $1.1 million. Then we turn to scenario two, the real estate appraisal the trial court excluded from consideration by the jury and from presentation during the course of trial. Excuse me. That real estate appraisal relied solely upon correction of a parking deficiency which results from the acquisition by the state of Texas. I apologize.
That's all right.
I swallowed you correctly. Getting back to scenario number two, which was not admitted by the trial court, Scenario number two relies upon the single-family lot. Scenario number two is a question of whether the single-family lot is permissible to be utilized for this additional parking loss. And the question...
Excuse me, when you talk about the single-family lot, you mean the same thing as what the state is called the dog leg?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the northeast corner of what is identified as the property being acquired in this proceeding. And I would like the court to take notice of the fact that when you look at evidence presented by the state as it pertains to the property involved in this litigation, the state puts one broad line around both tracts of land. But I would submit to the court that a accurate representation of what exists out there as of the date of take, April 22, 2009, is two separate lots, and that's demonstrated by Little Elm Plaza's aerial photograph at tab one on Appellee's brief. On that particular schematic, you will see the lot lines for the commercial tract, and you will see the lot lines for the single-family residential tract. The single-family residential tract is part and parcel of a residential subdivision which is north of the commercial tract. It is not part and parcel of the commercial tract. Hence, there are two separate pieces of property here which have two separate identified uses. And what happens in connection with scenario number two is the state's real estate appraiser makes the assumption, he makes the extraordinary assumption that the single family lot can be utilized for commercial purposes. The single-family lot can obtain a zoning change. And he makes these extraordinary assumptions based on his conversations with town representatives and based upon one property which had been rezoned near this single-family residential lot. He does not, I repeat, the state's appraiser does not utilize a highest and best use analysis with respect to the single family lot. He relies upon his extraordinary assumption. Further, the state's real estate appraiser does not go through the machinations, the mechanism, the analysis, the methodology courts have imposed for looking at property having an alternate use other than the existing use. And I would submit to you that the state has identified a case which handles that point, and that case was the Radler Pavilion opinion. In the Radler Pavilion opinion, we have a existing use, multi-tenant retail facility. During the course of the condemnation process, the landowner offered evidence that it would be best if it was redeveloped with an alternate use. In order to do that, the court clearly stated that that use has to be first, the land has to be adaptable to that use. Second, it has to be sometime in the immediate future or reasonable future, and it has to result in an enhanced value. In the Radler opinion, the landowner offered its evidence, and that property was adaptable to another use. But there was no testimony about whether that property would be available or adaptable in the immediate future or in the reasonable future, and whether the landowner himself would be in a position to develop that hypothetical use. And the court determined that the hypothetical use was a use that would have resulted in a windfall to that landowner. Because what happens is the landowner says, my property can be developed for a use, and in connection with this use, I can develop a parking garage. And when I develop my parking garage is impacted by an easement. And because of the easement, if I don't build my parking garage, you owe me $2 million. Alternatively, I can utilize a cost of cure on my hypothetical parking garage, and the state or the condemning authority will only owe $250,000. And if that's the case, that's what the evidence was presented to the jury. And the court determined that, first and foremost, you're making a decision based on a hypothetical use, and then you're making a decision about altering your hypothetical use and collecting damages on that hypothetical use. That's remote, speculative and conjectural, and the landowner was not permitted to utilize that because he didn't demonstrate that he would be doing that use in the reasonable foreseeable future.
But wasn't there evidence that it had been used as a driveway over this dogleg portion?
When we talk about the driveway in a single family property, there was much argument, much discussion, and much debate in the trial court about what to refer to the opening that existed on South Park Drive, which is where the property or the single family property fronts. And I would submit to the court that you've hit on what the trial court identified during the course of the proceeding, and that was, I can't call it a driveway because it's not permitted. There is no evidence or testimony that this driveway is anything that was approved by the city. Hence, he went to great pains to find a moniker or designation to deal with the driveway opening itself, and he determined that the curb opening, is how best to describe it so that it wasn't painted or valued with something that had been approved by the city. So is that a unity of use? Is that something which had been going on? Nobody can stop cars from doing what cars do unless you put up some sort of a barricade. And I would submit to the court that there was no evidence that that single family lot was in any way, shape, or form used with the commercial lot. The only thing that could even remotely be conceived as assisting the commercial lot would be access through there. And I would submit to the court that that access was illegal because there's no authorized permit for the driveway that exists out, or the curb opening which existed out there as of the date of take. And then, I'm sorry? Little Elm Plaza owns the single family residential lot. First and foremost, I'm not sure that Little Elm was in control of the opening. Little Elm purchased that lot along with the commercial track with that opening in place. And Little Elm, I suppose, to some extent, could have put up a barricade for that curb opening, but it was not a curb opening which was offered by Little Elm to the public for use with the commercial lot. There is no unity of use that can be argued there. And then with respect, finally, to the last point of error that is brought by the state alleges today in this appeal that a interpretation of Ordinance 918, which was never presented to the trial court, should now be applied to the real estate appraisals that were admitted during the course of trial. And I would submit to the court that the state's interpretation of Ordinance 918 is not an interpretation which was ever presented to the trial court so that he could make a determination. In fact, no one during the course of this proceeding ever requested the trial court to render a decision with respect to what Ordinance 918 means. I see that my time is up. No, Your Honor, you're absolutely correct.
Where is that even written?
If the court would permit me some time, but I would. It is contained within the brief, Your Honor, because it is relevant to how Ordinance 918 was ultimately applied to the Little Elm Plaza property in the real estate appraisals that were prepared and presented to the jury. It's important to understand exactly what the town was doing.
Thank you, Mr. Salazar. Ms. Bonin, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, Justice McCoy, with respect to your question about the city trying to get this property up to snuff, there was some evidence in the record to that effect. I'm not sure where it appears in the briefs, but, you know, that evidence, I think, is an explanation for why this letter was sent out 6 months prior to the date of acquisition. And, you know, within 3 weeks of that letter being sent out saying, oh, you have to fix everything, I guess someone at the city thought that the state's building, expanding the roadway was some sort of godsend for them to get rid of all the properties in the town that they didn't like. And so they sent out this rather absurd letter, which says that everybody's grandfathering is gone. And within 3 weeks, they passed Ordinance 918, and Mr. Taylor, the author of that letter, testified that Ordinance 918 superseded the letter. So, you know, the fact that, and at some point, that the city wished that it could bring every property in town up to snuff by using the state's acquisition as a way to do that is not evidence that that was the town's policy after Ordinance 918 was passed. I mean, this the property is not in mint condition. I think you can probably tell that from the record. The primary building was built in the 60s, the two smaller buildings in the 70s, and then a fourth building was built early in 2002. And you know, perhaps it's not in keeping with what the city of Little Elm is looking to for the future, but they clearly realized that they had no authority to take away everybody's grandfathering. Now, with respect to the request for rendition based on the cross issues, there's no basis for that. While they may have objected to testimony from state's witnesses based on alleged discovery violations, there was never any request for a rendition in terms of objecting to the issue or filing a JNOV. So there's simply no basis, however this case comes out, to order rendition based on the landowner's number. And I do believe that there was somewhere in the record some evidence that Ordinance 954 had been contemplated at the time of the acquisition. I will look, and if the court will allow me, I will provide a record cite to that in a follow-up letter. Now, with respect to the dog leg portion of the property, Little Elm argues that really that is two lots. But the fact of the matter is those two lots were purchased together as one piece of property, and as we've talked about, were used together. And initially, their own appraisers made those distinction. Both of their appraisers, one of who didn't testify at trial, didn't talk about the residential zoning at all in their appraisals. Instead, they said the entire property had a highest and best use as commercial property. With respect to the likelihood that this property would be, the zoning could be changed in the future, as they mentioned, there was a similar piece of property right across South Park Street that was changed to highest and best use. Now, with respect to the driveway not being approved by the city, nothing about this property was approved by the city because the property was built before the city of Little Elm or the town of Little Elm even existed. Pretty much everything about this property has been grandfathered in. And of course, the fact that there wasn't a specific driveway application doesn't change the fact that it was being used as a driveway. And Stacy Stanridge, Little Elm's general partner, testified that drive was used to access the shopping center. And you can find that at volume 11 of the reporter's record, page 50. Well, if if you look at, obviously they had that opinion, and that was the reason that Taylor letter was issued. But
that's an opinion. This person is recounting mm-hmm. a conversation with the town's mm-hmm. senior planner,
right.
Dusty McAfee.
Right. But the problem is that they took that conversation in the Taylor letter, and they drew a line and said, I'm going to put my hands over my ears, and I'm not going to listen to anything beyond that. I'm not going to listen from testimony from Mr. Taylor that, in fact, All of that policy was superseded by Ordinance 9118. I'm not going to do a fair interpretation of Ordinance 9118 itself, and I'm not going to take into account the fact that the city actually has adopted a concept plan that allows use the way the state thinks it should be used in the remainder situation. I think they initially saw the Taylor letter and decided that, great, you know, all the buildings have to be demolished, $4 million in damages. When further evidence was, you know, came to their attention that should have been considered, they didn't change their opinions because that would cause a reduction in the $4 million in damages, and obviously the client probably would have preferred that they not do that. And so they simply put their hands over the ears and never listened to anything beyond the Taylor letter. For all these reasons, we'd ask that you reverse the judgment of the trial court, give the state a new trial. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bonin. Mr. Salazar, we appreciate your arguments and your briefing. Along with Mr. Visayo and Ms. Caston, we appreciate you being here as well. Your case is now submitted, and that concludes the court for today, so we will adjourn.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned.